snow and sports gear. Her parents decided to learn skiing during the winter, but they also wanted to include their baby on the fun of snow sports. While snowboarding might be a bit too early for a toddler who can barely stand or walk, Yuji was not scared at all and even enjoyed it. China, which is hosting the Winter Olympics in a couple of months, is encouraging citizens to try ice and snow sports.
Every year, the roads across this tiny island in northwestern Australia turn scarlet just as millions of crabs leave their homes in the depths of the forest and start marching together all the way to the ocean where they can mate and spawn. The spectacular group voyage on Christmas Island happens after the first rainfall in October or November. And in order to give these red creatures the leeway, locals close off multiple roads across the island. They've even built a special bridge for the crabs so that they can cross the road unharmed. The mesmerizing migration is now a tourist attraction, drawing nature lovers from around the globe.
Paleontologists in Brazil have discovered remains that could belong to a species of dinosaur as yet unknown. The fossils were found at a site in northeastern Brazil. A team of scientists is trying to put together the bones and complete the huge dinosaur's skeleton. They think it lived during the Cretaceous period, which began around 145 million years ago and ended with extinction of all dinosaurs roughly 66 million years ago.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
The article you're about to hear has been penned by John White, an author and political commentator, under the heading UK's hypocritical designation of Hamas is a badge of honour. The article has been taken from PestTV.com website. God has given you one face, and you make yourself another. So writes William Shakespeare in his world-famous play, Hamlet. In words that do more to grasp the meaning of hypocrisy in human affairs than any number of worthy treatises on the subject could possibly come close to. Given recent events, the same words should be inscribed in huge letters above the entrance to the UK Parliament, the House of Commons. A building from which an unending number of high crimes and war crimes have issued throughout its long history, on the wings of the very hypocrisy that William Shakespeare describes. The latest example when it comes to the organized hypocrisy which passes for democracy on the part of a perfidious British political establishment is the news that the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is to be proscribed as a terrorist organization, a status previously accorded to its military wing, but which now, with this latest demarche, is to be enlarged to encompass its political wing as well. This decision by the British government is not per se an attack on Hamas, an organization which emerged and grew organically from the cruel soil of Israeli occupation, Israeli apartheid and ethnic cleansing. It is, in truth, an attack on the entire Palestinian people, and more significantly, the right of an oppressed and occupied people to resist their oppression and occupation by any means necessary. Just by way of a reminder, this particular right is enshrined in international humanitarian law, specifically under the rubric of Additional Protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions of 1949, recognizing the legality of wars of national liberation. No one, of course, will be surprised that the British government, indeed the entire British political establishment, refuses to acknowledge, much less recognize, the right of the Palestinian people to engage in a war of national liberation. Israel has only ever viewed the Palestinians as helots, that is, as an unpeople, unworthy of value, dignity, or parity of esteem, with their occupier condemned in the perverse collective colonial mind of average British ideologue to a future of national extinction rather than liberation. The renowned German playwright and anti-fascist Bertolt Brecht said it best: "The crimes pile up until they become invisible." This writer can conjure no more a simple yet cogent understanding of Britain's past and present as a first colonial, then latterly sub-imperialist power shorn of the ocean of propaganda deployed in service to the midst of Britain's standing in the world as a steadfast pillar of something described as the rules-based international order, where Britain, officially the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, is concerned. The crimes have not only piled up throughout its history, they continue to pile up until this day. Go and ask the people of Yemen, victims of Saudi Arabia's barbarism since 2015, with the material and active support of UK military forces, utilizing British weaponry in indiscriminate attacks against Yemeni civilians that shame a so-called international community. In truth, the West. This is a people whose continuing suffering stands as an indictment of Britain's foreign policy. Or how about the Syrian and Libyan people, both of which have lived experience of the chasm that exists between the words democracy and human rights in the mouths of British ideologues and the reality of an imperialist agenda rooted in nothing more squalid than hard power politics. Returning to the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas, the unimpeachable truth is that Hamas is a child of Israeli apartheid, Israeli ethnic cleansing, occupation and oppression. In the same vein, the Provisional IRA, the Irish Republican Army, was the child of British colonialism in the north of Ireland, rather than the other way round, and so on and so forth. Not the Palestinians can expect anything better from a UK Labour Party currently led by Keir Starmer. At the annual Labour Friends of Israel get-together, Keir Starmer gave the keynote speech, during which he voiced his opposition to the International Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, or BDS, campaign in solidarity with the Palestinian people. In his speech, Keir Starmer stated that under his leadership, Labour does not and will not support boycott, divestment and sanctions, or BDS. Its principles are wrong, targeting alone the world's sole Jewish state. Substitute Seoul African State for Seoul Jewish State, and you begin to reach the heart of the matter, which is that for the likes of Keir Starmer, apartheid is right. Resistance to apartheid is wrong. Occupation ethnic cleansing is right, and resistance to them is wrong. As for targeting alone, whoever else are the Palestinians supposed to target if not their oppressors? Boycott, divestment and sanctions is a campaign that originated in Palestine and was established by Palestinian civil society. It allows for the challenging of international solidarity on the basis of non-violence, inspired by the international campaign of boycott, divestment and sanctions that did so much to help bring down white South African apartheid to an end in the early 1990s. In the last analysis, this perfidious stance by the British government and official opposition when it comes to oppressed Palestinian people cannot be allowed to stand. Hamas's existence and resistance is not a choice. It is an absolute necessity in the context of the most prolonged, most brutal and murderous system of oppression in the world today. With this in mind, the group's designation as a terrorist organization by a British government drowning in hypocrisy and double standards is tantamount to a badge of honor.
Bandar Abbas, a day in the summer in 2019. The airplane gently lands on the runway. We immediately head towards the pier. An IRGC speedboat is waiting for us at the pier. After a while, we move towards an unknown destination at the heart of the Persian Gulf. It's sunny and the sea seems calm. But as we move deeper into the calmness, we reach a point that's been the center of media attention during the past few weeks. Suddenly, Stena Impero tanker emerges. Stena Impero is a UK-owned commercial ship that's been moored in the Persian Gulf for a few days. But the story started somewhere else, thousands of kilometers away in the Mediterranean.
Wandering in the fog.
On July the 4th, 2019, some news emerged in international media. It was a new escalating tension between the West and Iran.
Let's just return to our breaking news story coming out of the Mediterranean, and that's the fact that there are more arrests on the oil tanker.
Well, here is the Grace One. It's anchored at this point. There's a British warship in the distance, which we've seen patrolling. Moving now, then closer to the ship and further away again. There's also a police boat which has been swooping round and circling the ship itself.
It was stopped in waters just off the UK overseas territory on suspicion of breaking EU sanctions by taking oil to Syria.
Police in Gibraltar have been searching this ship from top to bottom for several days now, and they say that they have seized documents and electronic devices.
The Iranian oil tanker was delivering the Iranian oil to a purchaser who wanted to send it to Syria amid the fuel crisis in the country. But the European Union had imposed sanctions on delivering fuel to Syria. The British forces used it as a pretext to seize the Iranian oil tanker, Grace One, while European Union rules do not apply to Iran and the international waters. The illegal measure by the British forces was considered an act of piracy. However, they considered publishing the pictures of their Royal Marine Forces on the Iranian oil tanker as a show of might. The Iranian Foreign Ministry summoned the UK ambassador on that day. Iran's official stance was clear. Centuries before the US became the world superpower, the UK had the largest naval forces in the world. During the Pahlavi era, Iran's navy was dependent on the UK naval forces, but now, 41 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's naval forces are completely independent. Now, for Britain, seizing the Iranian oil tanker was a reminder of its power during the Pahlavi era. But Iran is ready to respond. This is where our story begins. The British frigate and the US destroyer were assigned with escorting British ships. Iran constantly monitors British ships. The British tanker had been advised to switch off its navigation system after arriving in the Hormuz Strait.
This is Safa of the Warship, the legal title of Islamic Revolutionary Guard Coordinated Warship. We are conducting our operation in order to defend our national sovereignty. Hence, you are requested to answer the following question. As I see, your AIS's turn is off. What is the matter? Over.
I will just have a look and check what is the problem.
This is Safa Warship. You are ordered to bear it on immediately.
Both teams were tasked with seizing the British tanker that had violated the rules.
Order to bear on your AIS immediately and hoist your flag. And also alter your course to a solid fire and keep close to your Iranian territorial waters immediately. Over.
A British tanker, Stena Impero, this is Sepa Navy, Channel 16. Do you read me? You are ordered to alter your course to 360. 360. I want to respect your ship for security reasons.
The British tanker disobeyed and did not stop. It was hopeful that a British frigate would arrive any moment.
British warship Foxtrot 236, sail 74, over.
British warship Foxtrot 236, this is Sepanevi Solborg. You are required not to interfere in this issue. British warship Foxtrot 236, this is Sepanevi Solborg. You are required not to interfere in this issue.
Sepa Navy Patrol Vessel, this is British warship Foxtrot 236. I am in vicinity of an internationally recognized strait with a merchant vessel in my vicinity conducting transit passage.
British warship Foxtrot 236, this is Sepa Navy Patrol Board.
The British military frigate knew well that it could not deal with the IRGC speedboats on its own, so it asked the Americans for help.
Someone maybe says the first word and the last word in the Persian Gulf. So you are ordered to keep well clear of me. This is my last warning, and you are responsible for any kind of dangers in your proceeding. Over.
The U.S. helicopter realized that it had to make the right decision or it would be destroyed.
I'm watching TV, my regular job cleaning.
After the tanker personnel were arrested, they were all interrogated over the violation.
At I was on the bridge.
What were you doing when the ship was seized?
I was having my dinner.
The time I was in the officer's mess room, and I heard announcement by chief officer. So captain immediately go on bridge.
I make announcement on the PA system for all the crew to come on the bridge.
Why are you filming? Why are your friends filming?
Because we are first time, our friend and me, first time see that situation. First time see.
Because it was the first time?
Yes. First time.
So the moment the special forces entered the ship, I was worried if the crew will get hurt. For the first 3 days, we were confined to the bridge. All the crew were on the bridge. After that, but they were polite. They were strict, but they were polite.
The tanker remained under IRGC command for a while, so lawsuits would be filed against the violators at a court inside the country.
No, I mean, this guard guys, like Iranian army, nobody touch us, nobody press us. They was polite with us.
Have you been treated badly during this month?
No.
Have you had any problem? Lack of provisions?
No.
Crew are contacting their family every day for 10 minutes. I thought it would be difficult, but they were always kind. I thought it would be more difficult, but they have been kind all the time.
After seizing the tanker that had breached the rules, Britain put an end to its naval piracy and released the hijacked Iranian tanker.
Iranian tanker seized on suspicion of EU sanction violations has been released by Gibraltar.
The Iranian tanker was in international waters near Gibraltar when it was hijacked by the British forces. Gibraltar was naturally part of Spanish territory, but it was grabbed by armed British seafarers 300 years ago and has been introduced as a British colony. The theft that took place 300 years ago emboldened the British naval forces to hijack the Iranian tanker near Gibraltar.
What's your opinion about the Iranian ship seized? I feel that...
What was wrong with it? Have they done anything wrong?
My opinion is that they have not done anything wrong. It's like another captain going his way to do his job, and the ship has been detained. That's my opinion.
But after the British tanker was stopped in the Persian Gulf and after the British government was punished, the court in Gibraltar issued a verdict that the Iranian tanker should be released. This came as the U.S. tried to stop the release of the Iranian tanker until the last moment.
That's despite reports of an 11th-hour U.S. move to keep the vessel detained.
But Britain, that was worried about its tanker in the Persian Gulf, bypassed the U.S. and immediately ordered the release of the Iranian oil tanker.
Chief Justice was told, was shown documents to the effect that the chief minister had given notice that the ship is no longer a specified ship within the provisions of the EU sanctions. And as it is no longer such a specified ship, there is no cause for its arrest, and therefore the arrest has lapsed immediately.
It's going to be released?
It has already been released. In legal terms, from the minute that the judge made his order, literally minutes ago, the ship is no longer any compulsion to stay within the jurisdiction.
After the Iranian tanker Grace One reached Iranian territorial waters, Tehran allowed the British tanker to leave on September the 27th, 2019.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
ECHO has all the potential to become one of the powerful economic and political blocs of the world if heads of member states strive to remove distrust by adopting independent and progressive policies without any dependence on the exploitative West. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading ECHO ought to materialize its powerful potentials. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The President of the Islamic Republic of Iran was the star attraction at the 15th summit of the Economic Cooperation Organization, ECHO, in Ashgabat. Dr. Sayed Ebrahim Raisi, in his speech at the summit, suggested that the 10-nation ECHO create an internal financial mechanism to boost its efficacy, and that Iran, as the founder member, along with Turkey and Pakistan, is ready to help connect the member states' fiber optic networks and promote artificial intelligence projects. He pointed out, in addition to its unique position in enjoying material features such as a population of 500 million that includes young and skilled manpower, as well as ownership of 1/3 of the world's energy resources, the ECHO has a privileged identity called Islam. All 10 ECHO members, including Iran, Turkey, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the republics of Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan, are Muslim states with a rich history of cultural, religious, social, and lingual commonalities. In the medieval era, Persian was the lingua franca of the whole region, which produced scholars and scientists of repute in various fields, thereby contributing significantly to the development of science, technology, culture, and civilization. Dr. Raisi's emphasis on inter-eco trade was noted by the media in view of the fact that the abundant natural resources of the vast region spreading from the borders of Europe in the west to those of China and India in the east could make member states immune from the pressures and illegal sanctions of the U.S. and other Western regimes. There are extensive areas of cooperation among eco countries, including banking transactions, boosting of road, rail, and air networks, setting up of joint industrial projects, and promotion of tourism. Moreover, Iran, with its extensive coastlines on the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman, provides the landlocked countries of Central Asia with the safest and most economical connection to the high seas and the international markets. Among other important issues facing eco states is security and the need to coordinate policies for confronting the problem of terrorism, whose chief promoter is the U.S., which has transported to Afghanistan the macabrely murderous Takfiri terrorists in thousands in order to keep that country in perpetual turmoil and to send them across the borders to destabilize neighboring countries. Without the least doubt, the regimes in Washington, whether Democrat or Republican, along with the illegal Zionist entity, are the avowed enemies of Islam and Muslim countries and should never be trusted. The Iranian president on the sidelines of the ECO summit held cordial talks with his counterparts from other member states, including host Gurban Ali Berdimuhamedov, whose country shares a 1,148-kilometers long border with Iran, stretching from the Caspian Sea to Afghanistan. ECO has all the potential to become one of the powerful economic and political blocs of the world if heads of member states strive to remove distrust by adopting independent and progressive policies without any dependence on the exploitative West.
A simple question.
British sport is once again under fire, and for an all too familiar problem, racism. This time the story flared up in English cricket, when one Yorkshire cricketer, Azeem Rafiq, revealed to a parliamentary committee that in his experience racism, without a shadow of a doubt, was widespread. He also claimed that, instead of facing up to the need to deal with it, abuse from his colleagues was not tackled and instead treated as a joke or friendly banter.
giving evidence to the Parliamentary Digital Culture, Media and Sport Select Committee, Azeem Rafiq stated English cricket is institutionally racist. He recounted the inhuman treatment he endured after his son was still born in 2017. Also, according to Rafiq, in cricket, racist language was used constantly, never stamped out, and the norm, and people didn't think it was wrong. Similar issues have also been reported in English football, with visibly ethnic players repeatedly enduring abuse from the terrace and from other players. The impact has been relentless and corrosive. In Azeem Rafiq's case, he believes he lost his career to the effects of racism over a prolonged period. However, former footballer John Barnes, who echoes the concerns and revelations of Azeem Rafiq, does not think the impact of such revelations will be an end to the issue. He believes institutions will just scapegoat people and think we're making a change by increasing ethnic representation in sport.
Why, after all these years, do racism and other forms of ethnic abuse appear to remain endemic in British sport? And what message does it send out to fans who watch from the terrace and see this sort of behaviour on the pitch? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. To what extent should sports people in the United Kingdom feel able to compete completely free of any form of racial abuse? We put that question to the public here outside London's iconic cricket ground, the Oval. Here's what they said.
Anyway, that's another story. Let me just ask you the question. Do with what we're talking about now.
Ready?
Okay. So there's no test of knowledge. I'm just going to fire a couple of questions and see what you think.
You're welcome.
We're here at Oval today. And
we're here today at the Oval. Yeah. And we're asking the public...
The recent allegations of racism in sport.
Sorry.
No. First question. To what extent should sports people in Britain be able to compete without racist abuse?
Yeah, of course there shouldn't be no racism at all.
I mean, it sounds extremely unfair that for so many they do end up going to play and just get heckled and their focus is drawn away from the sport that they're playing and suddenly their identity is being attacked.
Well, there's no racism, there's no discrimination of any kind, everybody just kind of gets brought together, that's what I love about sport.
Well, of course, you shouldn't have to worry about anything like that, you know, sport is sport. There shouldn't have to, any of those sort of issues shouldn't come anywhere near the sport, you know.
To what extent do you think that British sports people should be able to do their sport without any fear of racism or religious discrimination?
Oh, 100%.
Why?
Well, because it's not relevant to the sport that they're playing.
I know nothing about cricket, but what I know is that it's completely international, it's all over the world. So that's beautiful. It's something that should bring people together, not apart.
Yeah, of course. Like, I think racism and all this stuff, it's been, like, you know, for ages.
It's a great shame. It's something that's an ongoing battle by all accounts.
I'm from abroad. I can't imagine there's racism in British sports.
I believe racism is inborn.
Yes.
It's not avoidable easily.
Do you think that British sports people should be able to compete without fear of racist abuse?
I do. Unfortunately, it's very rife and has been for a very, very long time.
They said something on the news this morning. There's this whole thing about people excuse racism by saying it's banter. And this whole thing about bants that has suddenly become a byword for I can get away with saying anything. Oh, it's just bants, which it's not.
In reality, there is still racism ongoing. We know that is true. There's racism ongoing.
In the honesty of all of it, there shouldn't be any fear of it. I think we've come a long way. Like, British history and regards to colonialism has come apart a long, long, long way. 21st century, there shouldn't be any fear.
To be honest, I don't think any racism I observed. Absolutely. Yeah. It isn't just racist abuse. It's about sexist abuse. It's about inclusion. Everyone should be able to get to the best that they can possibly be.
People should be able to freely participate in any sport.
How does the public feel about cricketer Azim Rafiq and footballers claiming that British sport is institutionally racist?
Institutionalised? I'm not really sure. I wouldn't be able to give a definite opinion on that, but I mean, I can understand that there might be some elements to suggest that.
I think we've been letting it go on for too long, and in that sense it is institutionalised, it's part of the system.
In my standard and in my understanding, it was so exaggerated, and I disagree with you.
I couldn't tell you much about it, to be fair, Paul, but I did see a little bit, and as the case obviously needs to get stamped out.
Everyone that is racist or thinks racism should belong somewhere, wherever it might be, should not exist, in my opinion. Like, honestly, just change your mind. It's not a thing. It's 2021. Get over it.
That's kind of disappointing, because we're at like 2021, so we'll be we should be able to do whatever we want.
It's sad. You know, the fact is that we try to combat so many different elements, but it's still there.
There's one expression here in English language saying this is not cricket. So this means to me cricket is a very, very fair sport, and it can be open-minded to everybody.
Racism is not a good feeling. The outcome is horrible. People should really accept everyone.
I've lived in this country for about 40-something years. My family live in Australia. And I've always gone on about, in Australia, the racism, the sexism, the homophobia was always in your face. So you knew it was there and you could deal with it. In this country, there's a whole veneer of politeness. I didn't realize how misogynist men were in this country. It took me about 10, 15 years to work it out. And if I think that's the same thing, I think that's probably the same with racism.
I'm not surprised to hear about that, because I know that racism is many places in this country. Is practicable many places, both secretly and openly. We know of that.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was institutionally racist, but I think it's got opportunity to grow. You know, he would know more about it because he's in the field. But yeah.
And it makes me feel sad, but at the same time, it's just the reality. I mean, the British, the UK is quite institutionally racist.
I think it's been acknowledged that there is a massive problem that needs to be addressed. It may be not just in our sport, it might be across the culture of the country, but we're definitely going to deal with it.
Why is there still so much racism in British sport, is the public's opinion.
Just because England has got such kind of deep tradition, deep culture, especially with kind of like the British Empire colonialism only ending about, what, like 50 years ago.
I wish I knew. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing. I know, I'm lucky I don't experience anything like that myself, but I imagine it's terrible.
Don't know why. It could be jealousy. They earn plenty of money.
I think there was just an unawareness of, you know, what multiculturalism actually meant.
I couldn't tell you the reason why. I don't think it's sport-specific. But I think, obviously, with the emotions of sport, it comes out a little bit more. But either way, it's got no place.
Because sport is just, you know, a microcosm of of society.
To be honest, I think it's always been there. It's just like now we have more voice to say. Like before, as you say, we've been like a lot of people, a majority has been living with fear. And now we know, like, we are actually 2021 and we'll be able to express ourselves.
Because I think it's something that is institutionalized, unfortunately, that goes back many, many years.
When people are good, people have reason to pick on them. If people can't be like you, they want to antagonize you. As simple as that.
I think it's always been there and always will be. Hidden under the carpet, brushed under the carpet, whatever you call it. But I think it will always be anti-this, anti-that.
It's something of mine, because I know black people have contributed a lot to this country. You see, when black people do things good, they will say they are British. But when they commit crime, then they will say they are Nigerians or they are Afghanistanian or they are from Ghana.
I think the irony is fair, like, and that's the irony to the first question you asked, if there should be any fear around it. I think all racism comes from just fear, it's just ignorance.
I think, British people, they are very sporting, sporting-oriented people, and I read that is oil from my side.
They have this imperialist domination of the world that they show in the news and everywhere, and so that they think that also, they are entitled to discriminate other because their country discriminate other countries.
I think it's culture. I think the difficulty is culture, is that maybe that communities aren't encouraged to mix and understand each other.
Research by the Professional Cricketers Association revealed 25% had witnessed or experienced racism. Among ethnic cricketers, that figure rose to over 58%. 45% said it came from another player, with 39% saying it came from fans or on social media. 62% said it was disguised as banter. In football, using pre-COVID data, reports of racism rose by 43% between 2018 and 2019, with faith-based discrimination, including Islamophobia, going up by 75%, more than any other form of abuse. Over 70% of fans across England now think professional football in the country has a serious problem with racism. We asked the public, what impact does racism on the pitch have on racism in the audience?
I think that professional players in any sport, cricket, football, anything, they need to be role models, they need to be better, because they need to understand that their behaviour on the pitch is going to be emanated by thousands, by millions potentially of fans.
I think it's completely dependent on the fan. I mean, if the fan is anti-racism, it's devastating. If they are a racist, suddenly their way of thinking is actually being backed up and they're suddenly believing it to be acceptable.
The fans, they are not the very educated people, or there's so many different mixed group. Yeah, some of them maybe they are idiot or they say some things, but we cannot accuse whole the country because of some idiot in the fans. We cannot say that. Yeah, it could be.
Do fans take their lead from players, what they see on the pitch? Is that, there's an influence there?
I don't think so, but you never know. Everyone's totally different, but I don't think so. I don't think you see anyone specifically going from players themselves.
You know, if you're a public figure, you influence people in the bad way, in the good way. You get influenced by them.
Well, I'm assuming that the majority are going to be appalled if they see anything like that on the pitch. But then there's always going to be percentage that are like, thanks for, raising that I am a bigot and I want to be able to voice my bigotry. So, yeah.
I think in certain way, yeah, it could influence a lot, because, I mean, it depends of your mentality also, of your backgrounds.
There's still a lot of people out there that have their own views and try to put their views onto other people.
It affects people in different ways. Why is that? Because there's a certain, I'd say, middle class, establishment, whatever. There's this thinking that's that English exceptionalism. Get over it, guys,
Sometimes it makes potential immigrants to feel unsafe to come to this country. And at the same time, it makes many of us too, who have more things to contribute to the society, to reserve some and say, no, I better go and contribute this thing in another country where I'd feel I'll be safer and I will not experience such kind of racism that is obtainable here.
The racism on the pitch, if it's not addressed, I mean, it's legitimized,
We asked the public to comment on their view about what racist abuse in sport tells us about the state of racism in Britain.
I'd say that in sports, kind of like the true nature is brought out when you're kind of cheering for your fans, cheering for your team, and it can get a bit crazy. I think that if there is racism there, it does show a lot about kind of what's in the true nature of British people. And it's quite sad to see that as well.
There's clearly like a plague, a virus of racism that still you know, is deep embedded in the system, and it shouldn't be there. It should, you know, should be out, you know, something that players shouldn't have to worry about, and not something they have to, you know, worry about when they come to do the thing they love doing.
Well, I think it's a reflection of where we are as a society in some respects. I don't think it's any better or any worse, actually. I mean, I think, I was just reading this morning that the incidence of stop and search of black people in London has gone up by 24%.
It's not nice. It shouldn't be happening. And the fact that it keeps popping up is disgraceful.
Well, it doesn't say anything nice, but it's not like other countries don't have it. Like, it's not a British problem. It's, I think, it's a problem that every nation has, whether it's in sports or, I don't know, the show business, anything public.
No, it's the same all across the world, I think. Don't matter, just this country. It might be more publicised in this country, but it happens all over the world.
They always try to help me, and that's, I think, is another face of, like, London or, like, UK. Because, yeah, it have all this stuff that you're saying, but I also experience, like, the way that people help me a lot, and people has been being so helpful.
Well, Britain knows is there, is the head, and people are looking over, you know, up to them for good behavior and really giving people the satisfaction they want and tackling things like racism as it should be. So they should do better than this.
So what does racism in sport say about racism in Britain on the international stage?
Well, it's worrying, isn't it? It is worrying.
It gives a very negative reputation about the British society. The British society is a good place, it's a nice place to stay, to live, an organized society. But I think there are a few members of the society here who are practicing such racism that seems to be done by majority of the society of Britain, which is not the majority that practice that racism. It's just a few of them, but it's just that the few people that practice the racism here, they are dominant. That is the thing.
I think Britain is not as racist as other places. However, is it perfect? No. So it is a landmark, but it's got some stains on it, so it can be cleaned.
You know, the UK is part of the United Nations Security Council, and we've seen how they have undermined other countries at the international level, you know, with their culture, you know, the capitalistic, vicious capitalistic domineering culture, and it just transpires at the local level.
Yeah, I think the world is watching. The world is watching to make sure that we change our processes, and it's within cricket today, the meeting of every county board. All aspects of cricket has come to a conclusion that things need to change and things need to, and we need to engage with people. We need to actually engage and say, how can we make this right?
The evidence given by cricketer Azeem Rafiq confirms what many cricket players, footballers and other sports people have known for years. Racial abuse in Britain is widespread and committed by both players and fans. Many have their own stories of abuse to tell and can confirm that racist behaviour is frequently dismissed as a joke or not taken seriously by the organising, governing bodies of the sports.
These damaging revelations of a culture of racism in cricket, football and beyond suggest a deeply established presence of religious and ethnic abuse in British sport. And despite words of outrage from sports bodies and politicians, it still continues after all these years. Either because, at least until now, the sporting world couldn't put a stop to it, or because, quite simply, it hasn't cared enough to really try.
Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.